Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the December issue of Good Housekeeping magazine. Let's start with the Good Advice column, Everyday Manners. Our first question is about the holidays. Question: what should I do about sleeping arrangements when my college-age son and his girlfriend stay at our house during the holidays? I don't want them to share a room. Here's the answer. Your house, your decision. But don't wait until your son and his girlfriend walk in the door. Phone well before the visit and say, "We're planning to have Sheila stay in the guest room." If your son has other ideas, you can remind him that it is your home and you make the rules. A young adult may want to test the boundaries, but you don't have to give in. If you're accused of being old-fashioned, so be it. There are worse things to be called. Our next holiday question. We always give $20 holiday tips to the mailman, the trash collector, and my hairdresser. But this year, we can only afford to give $10. Should we apologize in our card for the smaller gift? Here's the answer. You don't have to acknowledge the reduction. It doesn't mean you value these people any less. All it shows is that you can't express it in the same way this year. Include a handwritten message that expresses your gratitude and add details that really let them know you've noticed how well they do their jobs. You might also include a small gift, such as homemade cookies. Rest assured, you won't be the only ones cutting back this year. Next question. For the past 2 years, my 20-year-old nephew has gotten drunk at our family Christmas party. My 14-year-old son thinks it's hilarious, but I want him to know that this behavior isn't acceptable. Is it rude to ask my brother to keep an eye on his son for the sake of mine? Answer: no. Because your nephew is under the legal drinking age in most states, you may be liable if he drinks in your home and then drives. That's reason enough to put an end to his drunken holiday celebration, even without the negative influence on your son. You can enlist your brother's help, but your nephew is old enough to take responsibility for his own actions. Call him before the holidays and let him know that you look forward to seeing him, but that he won't be served alcohol in your home. And if he shows up drunk, you'll ask him to leave, providing him with a safe ride. You might say something like, "I've spoken to your folks about this problem, but I'm asking you directly not to set a bad example for your cousins. And we can't visit with you when you're drunk. The best gift we could receive is to have you really with us. Even if the gathering is at someone else's house, speak up in advance. Talk to your son, too. You might say, 'I know you thought it was funny that John was drunk last year, but he ruined a good time for other guests, and it's really dangerous for him.'" Here's our last holiday question. My husband doesn't get along with my extended family, but I look forward to spending the holidays with them. What's the best way to compromise without making him miserable? Answer: you can make the visit more tolerable for him and still enjoyable for you. First, keep it short and sweet. Let your family know in advance that you have other obligations that preclude an extended stay. Saving your husband from Noel hell is certainly an obligation. If travel is involved, perhaps you could stay with the family member he gets along with best, or at a hotel. This will give your husband some downtime. If relatives are bunking with you, encourage your husband to make other plans for part of their stay. He shouldn't disappear for their entire visit, but it's okay to keep FaceTime at a minimum. Our next article is called Zip It: How to Help a Loved One Who's Struggling with Bad Eating Habits. Stop Nagging Now. This article is by Janine Roth. My father was a coffee drinker, 8 cups a day, black, each with three sweetened loaves. When we went out to eat, he ordered fried chicken or greasy hamburgers, and before the meal came, he'd polish off the contents of the bread basket, slathered with butter. For dessert, he'd ordered rice pudding or cheesecake. "I don't like eating anything green," he'd say. "All my favorite foods are either brown or white, and I intend to keep it that way." At 75, he was overweight and lethargic. I'd tell myself scary stories. The butter is clogging his arteries. He's going to die of a heart attack. I was so worried, I flew to New York from California to be his cheerleader, nutritionist, and exercise trainer. I lectured him at meals, dragged him to buy workout clothes, then schlepped with him around the track near his apartment for a half an hour every day. "Come on, Dad," I say. "You can do it." I believed that his health and his heart were in my hands, that I could make him change, that I was his life coach. It didn't work. The minute I left, he ate his favorite brown and white foods and spent his time watching television, not walking around the track. When he died, it was of lymphoma, not a heart attack. During the last few months of his life, I was begging him to eat any food at all, no matter what color. So much for my theories. I was reminded of this a few weeks ago when I got two letters about helping. Okay, making people change. One woman wrote, "My sister has high blood pressure and high cholesterol, and I'm worried sick about her. I give her articles about what to eat, but she doesn't seem to read them. Her eating stays exactly the same, high fat, high sugared foods, and she won't exercise. We've been best friends forever, and I can't stand watching her health deteriorate. Please tell me what I should say to her. What can I do for her? I'm desperate." Another woman wrote about her husband. "We've been married for 40 years, and I want him to be around for the next 40. But he's 30 pounds overweight, has diabetes, and eats cookies and cakes regularly. The doctor tells him to cut down on carbohydrates, but he doesn't listen. I think he's eating emotionally. He just lost the job he had had for 35 years, and he's miserable. He doesn't know what to do with himself, and so he eats. I keep telling him that he needs to stop. Help. I know what it's like to want the best for someone you love and to believe that you know what that is. My father wasn't the only person I attempted to fix. I also used to lecture my husband about food, giving him the look for eating a third piece of bread. I say, 'People pay me for this, honey. I know what I'm talking about.' Unimpressed, he'd say, 'I'm glad people pay you, but I'm not one of them, so please keep your advice to yourself, honey.' After he said this to me enough times, I realized that he was right. I couldn't change him. I also realized that my fabulous advice was having an opposite effect. Instead of eating less, he'd eat more. And since I spent years doing exactly the same thing, eating as a reaction to someone else's judgment, I understood why. It's oppressive for the one being pushed, and it's a losing battle for the pusher. It never works. When people ask for my opinion, when they come to a retreat or read a column, it's a great fit. But when I try to force what I believe onto someone who isn't interested, we both end up feeling the same way. Miserable. I wish I could have back all those moments when I pushed my father to change. I wish I'd spent them laughing with him, talking to him, enjoying him. After many failed attempts to boss around the immediate universe, here's what I learned. I can't know what's best for another adult or the purpose that a particular behavior is serving in his or her life. It's not my business to dictate how somebody else lives or what she puts in her body. Sometimes it takes a full-blown crisis for a person to realize that she really wants to feel well and that eating a particular way makes her sick. But whenever that realization occurs, it's hers, not mine. It has to be hers if she is to follow through on her resolve. No one else can do it for her. And while I sometimes hate that fact when I'm the one trying to change, I wouldn't mind someone else doing the hard work. I realize that it's my responsibility to take care of my body. Accepting that is the only way I've ever made lasting changes. I've also learned something important about why I boss people around. I may tell myself it's out of love, and love is certainly a part of it, but it's really about me, not them. Ouch! When I'm busy over there in their lives, my attention isn't here on my own, on the things that I need to improve. One of my students told me that she and her husband were getting into daily fights about his eating. I asked her what she thought would happen if he didn't start eating the way she thought he should. "He'll die young," she said. "Then I'll be all alone. I won't be able to make it." She was so convinced by the story she spun that she was making herself and her husband miserable. The truth, of course, was that she didn't know what was going to happen. None of us do. Few of us get through life without having to deal with pain and loss. We all hope we handle it well. But the real pickle for most of us is the misery we put ourselves and others through by treating imaginary disasters as though they're real, and then trying to control them. When I became my father's unwanted life coach, when I counseled my husband on his eating habits, I was so caught up in anticipation of loss that I ignored the people who were right in front of me, very much alive. Because of that, we all suffered needlessly. There are still times when I have to stop myself from trying to be the boss of everyone, but I've managed to control these urges by becoming aware of when I'm telling myself a story about how someone should be, when I could be simply accepting the people I love for who and what they are. It just takes practice. The next time you're tempted to run someone else's life, ask yourself a few simple questions. Am I focusing on an imagined future instead of what's right in front of me? Is there something in my own life that I should be paying attention to? And most important, how much better will I and the people I'm nagging feel if I give up trying to impose my beliefs on them? I can tell you how you feel. Much, much happier, and so will the people you love. Our next article is The Gift You Give Yourself. Even though it may seem impossibly hard, forgiving can have astounding benefits for both your body and your soul. Here's a look at when and how to do it. This article is by Jenny Graves. The night before Thomas Ann Hines' 21-year-old son, Paul, was murdered, she spoke with him on the phone. "I had a bad cold," and he said, "If you're still sick tomorrow night, I'll come home and take care of you," she recalls. She told him she'd be fine. Still, she was surprised when she didn't hear from him the following night. He wasn't the kind not to check in. As it turned out, Paul, a senior at the University of Texas at Austin, was at a video arcade where a 17-year-old boy asked him for a ride. When inside the car, the boy pulled a gun and demanded that Paul give the keys to him. Paul refused. The boy shot him twice, once in the arm and once in the heart, and fled, leaving Paul slumped over his car and Hines' life in ruins. The Austin Medical Examiner office called her at 12:50 a.m. to tell her Paul was dead. "I was shattered, beyond shattered," she said, of that night in 1985. "I had been a single mom since Paul was 8 months old, and he was my world." The boy who shot Paul, Robert Charles White, was sentenced to 40 years in prison, and Hines was incarcerated in a cell of her own making. "I worked, then went home, cried, screamed, and walked the floor," she said. "I couldn't stand being with my friends because they couldn't handle my anguish. They tried to help, but I didn't want to hear things like, 'He's in a better place, so I isolated myself and fed my anger. I wrote letters and made phone calls to the parole board to make sure Paul's murderer never got out of prison. I woke up every morning thinking, I hope that guy dies today. For 13 years, Hines was bent on vengeance, and when she was given the opportunity through the Texas Victims Offender Dialogue Program to meet Paul's murderer face to face, she jumped at the chance. My plan was to make him understand what he had done. Taking Paul's baby shoes and a baby picture with her as ammunition, she met White, by then 30 years old, at the prison in Gatesville, Texas. I said to him, "If you knew how much I loved him, you wouldn't have killed him," she recalls. He put his head down on the table and started crying. I gave him a tissue, and something inside of me cracked. I could tell he was ashamed and that he helped me feel a little sympathy. It sounds crazy, but I almost felt maternal toward him. I knew his history, and it was awful. When he was 12, he watched his older brother kill a man. And when Charles, the name White goes by, killed Paul, he was not much more than a boy himself. As we sat there, I started to see him as a human being and not just as a murderer. They talked for nearly 8 hours until finally an exhausted Hines reached across the table and put her hands in his. In that moment, I was transformed, she recalled. I was holding the hand of the man who murdered my son, and I didn't hate him. He never said, "I'm sorry," and I never said, "I forgive you," but I knew he felt genuine remorse for what he had done. Prison is an extremely macho environment, and he was taking a big risk by allowing himself to cry and being emotionally vulnerable in front of those guards. I truly believe we came to a place of peace that day. While Hines' transformation seems almost superhumanly virtuous, most of us were raised to believe that we should try to forgive people who hurt us. Most major religions teach the value of forgiveness. In the Lord's Prayer, we promise to forgive those who trespass against us. And the idea is so widely accepted, it's become a guiding principle of our culture. But putting forgiveness into practice can be tougher than it sounds, and not just in extraordinary circumstances like Hines. What if your husband had a fling with the sitter? Or your sister tried to treat you out of your inheritance? Could you forgive? How would you get past the hurt and the anger? It often seems like someone who hurts you isn't worthy of forgiveness. But forgiving is something you do, not only for the other person, said Everett Worthington, a Ph.D. at Virginia Commonwealth University. You do it for yourself, to get rid of the anger, resentment, and desire for revenge that can weigh you down like an emotional ball and chain. Indeed, this seamless, selfless act may be one of the most profound gifts we can give ourselves. According to recent studies, letting go of grudges not only helps mend fractured relationships, but also offers surprisingly powerful emotional and physical health benefits. When you don't embrace forgiveness, that leads to angry thoughts and active hostility, which release stress hormones. Those, in turn, create wear and tear on every part of the body, says Fred Luskin, Ph.D. of the Stanford Forgiveness Project. If you're angry, it makes sense to stay mad for a day or two, but our bodies weren't meant to absorb that stress for weeks or months at a time. Because forgiveness interrupts the physiological response to stress, it's a potent antidote. The medical case for forgiving is pretty powerful. In 2005, researchers from Duke University Medical Center found that of 61 patients with persistent lower back pain, those who scored higher on a forgiveness scale, a measure of how successfully they could let go of hurt and anger when feeling wronged, reported lower levels of pain, anger, and psychological distress. In 2006, researchers at a Florida hospital reported that when people with high blood pressure and high anger scores participated in an 8-week forgiveness training program, most achieved significant reductions in blood pressure. And researchers from the University of Tennessee found that people who were more forgiving had lower stress levels and lower levels of reported illness. The evidence that forgiveness affects emotional health is equally persuasive. Researchers from the University of Wisconsin at Madison have found that forgiveness therapy, which involves coaching on how to overcome resentment, can help emotionally abused women feel less depressed, anxious, and stressed, as well as improve their self-esteem. What makes forgiveness such an emotional bomb? It reduces overthinking, which is implicated in almost every mental health disorder, especially depression and anxiety. Even if a person isn't dealing with such a dark mood, letting go of hurt and anger is a profound spirit lifter. But getting to the place where you can truly forgive and reap those benefits isn't always easy. These steps can help. Learning to let go. While Debbie, 56, of Palm Beach, Florida, discovered that her husband of 13 years was having an affair, she swore she'd never speak to him again. The hurt, the sense of betrayal, the anger, it was all overwhelming. "I ended the marriage immediately," she said. The day before their divorce became final, she received an email from him that said, "I am truly sorry for subjecting you to this heartache." Although she was still so upset, it didn't have much impact. She saved the note. "I think I wanted to remember that he felt some regret, that he was a decent guy after all." Then about a year later, she ran into him into a cafe. "When I saw him, it was like time stopped. The physical surrounding receded in the background. All I could see was his face, and I realized I had a choice. I could speak to him or continue being angry. In that moment, I knew I didn't want to pour more energy into my grief and anger, so I said hi. It was such a relief, like a weight had lifted." Her ex seemed relieved and grateful as well. "We fell into conversation very easily. I realized that forgiving someone isn't the same thing as saying what he did is okay. My ex is basically a good guy who made a mistake, and he feels bad about it. I don't think I could have forgiven him if he hadn't been contrite. We've gone on to become wonderful friends." Margaret experienced what Charles Griswold, a professor at Boston University, says of perfect forgiveness, in part because she received apology, which helped her let go of her anger. "I'm sorry doesn't always lead effortlessly to I forgive you, but it can make the idea easier to swallow," he says. A psychology professor at the University of Miami says one study which found that apologies increase the likelihood of forgiveness by 200%. He said, "Something to remember the next time you're the guilty party." Receiving a sincere apology not only restores your self-respect and dignity, but also forces the wrongdoer to suffer the humiliation of admitting his shortcomings. An apology doesn't erase the wrong, however, nor does it mean you have to let the perpetrator off the hook. People should pay the price for their actions, whether it's divorce or prison. But those lie in the social realm, says Worthington. Forgiveness is an individual choice. It happens inside your own skin. It's personal. Forgiveness is so personal, in fact, there's no one-size-fits-all formula. For many people, it takes years of soul-searching therapy or prayer. Some, it happens in a flash. In June of 2000, Susan's 16-year-old son died of leukemia, and one of her oldest friends had avoided mentioning the loss. "She just changes the subject when my son, about my son or how I'm coping. What's worse, this is someone I nursed through a dozen of emotional crises, and when I really needed her, she's nowhere. I've tried to remind myself that she has problems of her own. She's a single mom, and her teenagers are going through a tough time, but I'm still incredibly hurt that she doesn't check in to see how I'm doing. I'd like to forgive her for that. It's upsetting to feel angry at an old friend, and I like the idea of having her in my life, but I wonder if it's worth it." Surprisingly, this kind of situation may be an excellent one in which to forge ahead, if you adopt a fresh perspective. Forgiveness can seem impossible if you see it as a gift to the person who wronged you. But if you think of it as something you do for yourself to restore your own peace of mind, it's easier and more appealing. If you see forgiveness as your choice, then no act is technically unforgivable. It may take some time to get to the point where you're ready to forgive. And if the person who hurt you is unapologetic, the process takes more effort. If you don't get an apology, you are left with the less satisfactory alternative of constructing a narrative about the offender that makes him seem more sympathetic and more worthy of forgiveness. For Susan, who already tried to imagine the pressures of her friend's life as a single mom, that meant simply acknowledging and trying to feel sympathy for her. Our studies have shown that people judge a wrong as far more forgivable if they can empathize. Being able to put yourself in the wrongdoer's shoes, whether it's a spouse or a stranger, can help you gain insight into the behavior, which can make forgiveness easier. That may sound like rationalizing, but the truth is, we explain away people's bad behavior all the time. When your husband is in a foul mood, you chalk it up to stress at work. When your child throws a tantrum, you figure she's probably tired. But that doesn't mean you should force forgiveness. You can decide that you're going to try to open your heart to forgiving. But until you let the anger and resentment run the course, you're not able to do that. The ability to emphasize may come quickly or not for years. Women in particular may feel pressure to grant a pardon too quickly. Before you forgive someone, you need to make sure that you're not just doing it because you feel unladylike. Feeling anger when you've been wrong is actually a sign of healthy self-respect. Forgiveness doesn't mean you have to feel warm and fuzzy towards someone who did something wrong. But ask yourself, do I want to walk into the future laden with these rocks from the past? Or do I want to ditch the rocks so I can be free? Forgiveness is more of a decision than a feeling, more of a process than a moment. Here are 7 steps to forgiveness. Step 1. Allow yourself to feel anger. Before trying to let go of the hurt, consider how bad you feel. Maybe you need to express your needs to more often. Forgiveness is not about being a doormat, but it's about feeling safe and empowered. Step 2. Talk about it with a trusted friend or therapist. Not only can this help you sort out how you feel, it can help you see alternative viewpoints. Step 3, calm yourself when you start feeling upset. When you think about something upsetting, your body goes into the fight or flight mode, making it harder to be rational. All you have to do is go for a walk or talk to someone to calm down. Step 4, empathize with the person who hurt you. Put yourself in her shoes. We've all done things we weren't proud of. By remembering that, you can put yourself in a more forgiving frame of mind. Step 5. Remind yourself that forgiveness is a gift to yourself. It's easier to think of your own self-interest than that of another. Step 6. Commit to forgiveness. Step 7. Relish the release. The sense of peace feels good. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the December issue of Good Housekeeping Magazine. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time.